עוד זקן ושבע ימים. ראיתי כבר ברוחות עזות ורעמים. אתה עלה קטן מתנועה, בטוח בעצמו הכל יודע. קח איתך צידה לדרך את ניסיוני, אל תזלזל, אולי זה כל מה שיש לי. כי יש ימים יפים הכל פורח, ויש שעות קשות הכל בורח. תמיד הכל בחוץ בהיר, ברוח סער וסופה קרה. תזכור ותתחזק, אני איתך. תחזיק חזק על הקטן שלי.
Good evening, everyone. This week's parsha is Parsha's Boy. The highlight of the parsha is Yetzias Mitzrayim, the actual exodus from Egypt. However, the parsha begins with a few makis, the last three plagues, which led up to the redemption. And the dramatic climax of the parsha is definitely the onset of the last plague, the plague of the firstborn, as the pasuk relates, "Vayehi b'chatzi ha'layla," and it was at the stroke of midnight. Hashem hika kol b'chayr, and Hashem killed out all the firstborn. This definitely was the plague of the firstborn, is what finally broke the shackles, the chains of the Egyptian bondage, and set the Jewish nation free. It's interesting that the Torah is so clear that this plague was going to begin exactly at midnight. It was at midnight, b'chatzos, that's when the Makkah was going to take place. And we don't find that by any of the other Makkahs, but the any other plagues, that there should be in a clear, precise moment of when the Makkah was to begin, or at least the Torah doesn't tell us about it. There is by one Makkah, by the Makkah of the frogs, by the Makkah of the Tzfardeya. Over there is a set time, but that's not to the coming of the Makkah, but the actual stopping of the plague. Because Moshe asked Paro, "When should I pray for you that the Makkah should stop?" And Paro said, "Daven for tomorrow." But even then, it's only tomorrow. It wasn't the exact moment. It was the day, that it should be the next day. Over here, however, there was such a clear emphasis that the Makkah is going to begin exactly at the stroke of midnight. And this is so strongly emphasized that all the way from the beginning, when Hashem tells Moshe, and he informs him about this plague, and he tells him to go to Pari, and warn Pari about it, he tells him to tell him that this was going to take place at Chatzos, at midnight, which actually put Moshe Rabbeinu in a dilemma. Because Moshe knew that if he was going to come to Pari, surrounded by his magicians and his sorcerers and his astrologers, and he's going to tell them about the time that the Makkah is going to take place at Chatzos, they're going to set their clocks to see if the word, if Hashem's word is going to be fulfilled to the last detail. And being that it's possible that their time would be off by just a tiny bit, and then they would question and then they would doubt the word of Hashem, or at least be able to say that it wasn't exactly like Moshe said. So Moshe had to change it a little bit and say that the Makkah was going to be Kachatzos HaLayla, as midnight. But why was it necessary? Who cared? If Moshe would come to Pari and tell him, "Pari, listen here, in a few days, now it's the 10th of Nisan, in a few days, in the 15th day of the 15th night of the month, a horrific plague, a terrible plague was going to descend on Egypt." What would be wrong with that? Why does he have to say that the Makkah was going to be at the stroke of midnight? Another thing we find interesting in regards to the Makkah's Bechoris, is that over here there is instructions about the Jews protecting themselves and exactly how they have to protect themselves, certain precautions that they have to take that we don't find by any of the other makas. First of all, the Torah says to the Yidden that they're not allowed to leave their homes. Atem lo yiseitzu mipesach beischem. No one is allowed to go out of their homes during that night, because if they go out of their homes, they might be harmed. They could be hurt. So to protect themselves, everybody has to stay indoors. And even indoors, in the safety of their own homes, they still weren't safe. They had to make a sign on the house to indicate this is where a Jew lives, that they shouldn't be hurt. And the sign was that they had to take the blood from the Karban Pesach, from the Paschal Lamb, and put it on the doors, on the two doorposts, and on the lintel. Now, in the Pasuk itself, it mentions only the blood of the Pesach. However, in the Midrashim, Targum Yonason, and in the Zohar, and perhaps in Pirkei de Rabbi Eliezer, where over there it says clearly that there was another blood that they put. It was the blood of their circumcision. Right before the Jews left Egypt, there was a mass circumcision. They all had to circumcise because the law is in regards to the Karban Pesach, that an uncircumcised male may not partake in the eating of the Karban Pesach. So they were all circumcised, and they were told to take from that blood too. So they put two types of blood on the doorposts of their homes. But the question is why? Why do they need this all? But the other place, they didn't need it. Why should there be any reason that they would be hurt? The Makkah is clearly coming to punish the Egyptians, to hurt the Egyptians, not for them. So why do they have to put any sign to protect themselves? It's interesting. Now, Rashi does say that in regards to the Makkah's Bechoyres, and the reason they needed all these precautions was because Kivan Shenitin Rishus Lamashchis Einoy Mavchin Bein Tzadik L'Rosh, that when it is given permission for the Mashchis, for the destructive forces to do what it needs, whatever it's going to do, he doesn't differentiate between the righteous and the wicked, with the innocent and the guilty. And therefore, if they might get hurt. If they're outside or even in their homes, if they don't have a sign. But what's with all the other plagues? The other plagues is not a mashchis. The other plagues is not destructive. The other plagues were pretty bad. And some of them were actually fatal to human beings. Some of the plagues broke the infrastructure, the economic infrastructure of Mitzrayim, the livelihood, the livestock, and so forth. The food supply. But there were plagues that were very harmful and devastating to human beings. Like the plague of the wild beasts and the plague of the hail, bara. It doesn't say how many were killed, but it's possible that thousands of people were killed. And it doesn't say that the Jews would have to do something to protect themselves. It says they would be protected, but it would be protected by Hashem. V'flesi, I will separate the land of Goshen, they won't be hurt. But the Jews themselves, they didn't have to make a special sign on their doors in order to protect themselves. Why? And why Davka with it? It's also a mashkes. And then the interesting thing is, it's precisely by Makkah's Bechores where we say in the Agada that Hashem says, Vavarti Beretz Mitzrayim, I will cross in the land of Egypt, Ani v'loy Malach. It's I myself, Ani v'loy Ashliach. It's not through an agent. It's Hashem himself who will bring about this plague. So who's talking about a mashkes? A kind of destructive flow of force that might harm everyone. Now, in a simple way, looking at it from just a simple note, we can say that the sages are very precise in their wording. They say that kivon shenitin rishus l'mashchis, permission was granted to the destructive force to destroy, to harm. See, in all the other nine plagues, they could have been very, very violent, but the plagues themselves were very directed and limited to a specific function, a specific action. That the plague was going to hurt the Egyptians, but only in one specific way. It was narrowed down. So we understand that during the plagues, besides the physical plagues, they were spiritual forces of destruction, demonic forces that came along and were involved in perpetrating and bringing about this destruction. But nevertheless, they themselves had their hands tied. That they had to act within the certain parameters and guidelines of the natural cause of this kind of plague. Like we see it by the hail, by the bara, it's very clear. It says over there that all the trees were hammered and crushed. The the but the pasuk says clearly that the wheat was crushed and the wheat was broken, but the barley survived. And the reason for that was the wheat was rigid, was firm, was stiff because it was ripe already. So it took a beating when the hail came down and was hammering down on it. It broke, but the barley was still wasn't ripe yet, so it was pliable and soft and bendable. So we see from here that the makkah, the plague, was so limited to work within the confinements of the natural effects and consequences of that plague. By makkah's b'chores, however, it was different, because by makkah's b'chores, it doesn't say, even though there was a specific group of people that were targeted by this plague, but within that group, it doesn't say how they should die. Anyway. So the mashchis was let loose. The killer, the monster, was let loose. Once he's let loose, then you don't know what he can do. Then he's going to be very violent. Then that's when his restraints, when his cage is opened up and he's let out to harm, to hurt, so then you don't get into his way, because then everybody is in danger. And that is why they needed special protection by this makkah. Now, to take it a step further or a little deeper, there's a difference between the makkah's b'chores, the plague of the firstborn, and all the other ones, in the very content of what the makkah was all about. By the plagues, by the first plagues, the Torah is very clear that the makkah wasn't just merely to punish Egypt. That too, of course. And each one was a specific punishment for various different crimes that they did. But the makkah, as the pasuk describes, had a different function. It was to teach the Mitzrayim a lesson. The pasuk says, "V'yadaitem ki ani Hashem." They should know that I am Hashem. The Egyptians worshipped nature. They believed in Mother Nature, that is the superpower, and there's nothing beyond that. And the makkah came to teach them that Hashem is the boss over nature. He created nature, he transcends nature, and nature in his hands, and he can manipulate it as he wants it. And every makkah came and broke and destroyed another natural phenomenon. That was with all the other makkahs. Not so makkahs b'chores. Makkahs b'chores had the function of breaking, of punishing Egypt. Like the pasuk says, "Bini b'chori Yisrael, you messed with my firstborn son. I will kill and I will destroy your firstborn." This was a makkah about punishment. Like you see clearly, it's clearly seen, and all the other plagues, there were survivors. Those that the plagues that were affected by the plague, which was all of Egypt, there were so many of them that survived. They maybe were injured, they were harmed, they suffered monetary losses, and so forth. They survived so they can learn a lesson. There were those who can have the yadaitem ki ani Hashem, to know that I am Hashem. By makkah's b'chores, it wasn't that way. Those that the makkah targeted, there were no survivors. They were all killed out. Everybody else, the other people, the makkah didn't come to them at all. They weren't harmed at all. They weren't even scratched by the makkah. So the makkah which was directed against the people, those that it was directed against, they perished. So there was no v'yadaitem, no one to know. Others, of course, suffered emotionally. They suffered from the terror and the fear of that frightening night. But the actual makkah was not on them. So you see that this makkah was about breaking Egypt. And it's for that reason, since it was about punishment, this is what put the Jewish people in jeopardy. This is what put them in limbo. Because the status, or the condition or the spiritual condition of the Jewish people at that time was very poor. Jews were steeped in idolatry. They had learned and picked up various different pagan rituals. And they were very sinful. And in a very, very, very lowly state. We find later in next week's parsha, in Parshas Bishalach, when the Yidden came to the sea didn't want to split, because there was prosecuting angels who were saying, these serve idols and they serve idols. Why should they drown and they should survive? It's not fear. And the same thing was at this Makkah, Makkah's Bechorah. Why should they be killed and they should be and they should survive? They're sinners just like them. That is why at this Makkah is where they needed protection, much more than by the other place. Because here there was a reason that they can be harmed. Parenthetically, going back to the question we said earlier, there is no mashkes. Hashem Himself was the one who brought the plague of the firstborn. So the Zohar asked this question. And the Zohar says, what do you mean mashkes? What kind of mashkes? It's Hashem. And the Zohar says, the mashkes came along. There were satanic forces that came along. Why? Precisely for this reason. To instigate the plague against the Jew too. To point an accusing finger against them, that they too deserve to be punished if the Egyptians are punished. So if they understand that, that is why they needed protection by this Makkah more than the other plagues. And two kinds of protection. First of all, on the street, where the mashkes with destructive forces is running rampage. Over there, don't be there at all. Keep out of the street. Even in a more safe place, in your own home, where sort of you're not in the killer's path. Nevertheless, you're still in danger of the accusing fingers, the pointing fingers, saying that they too have sinned. And that is why they needed to put their sign of protection. However, if this is the case, and if it's because there was an accusation against the Yidden and they were under the threat of annihilation just like the Egyptians, so then we have to understand, what does the ois help? What is putting blood on the carbon Pesach and the meal, putting on the door, and that's going to sign. That's going to help them. How is this going to refute the argument of the prosecution? It's a good argument. So what are you saying? So yeah, did it. You might say, well, it's a mitzvah. So the schus of the mitzvah will be protected. But it doesn't work that way. Chazal tells us that ein mitzvah mechaba aveda vein aveda mechaba mitzvah. One thing doesn't cover for the other. If a person sinned, he has to be punished for his sins. You did mitzvahs, you can be rewarded for your mitzvahs, but the mitzvah cannot cover for the sin. If you did the crime, you need to do the time. So they would be, so what do you mean? So they did the mitzvah. That's nice. But if the punishment is due to them, and there was a reason that they should be harmed, and this should have happened, God forbid. So how does the ois, how does the sign help? However, to understand this, we have to get a little bit philosophical. And just bear with me for a couple of moments. The Kabbalists and Hasidic writings, there is a great fundamental principle. We mentioned it a couple of weeks ago in a class, The Great Battle in Part 1. Hashem, the creator of the world, transcends the creation. When we say he transcends the creation, it's not just the physical aspects of the creation, but even the subtler aspects. Things that to us, they feel absolute. They feel like just the concrete reality. Hashem is beyond them, for like time and space, particularly time. To us, time is, we can't imagine existing beyond time. But Hashem is not time bound. He is beyond time. So the Kabbalists take it a step further. And they say that Hashem transcends reason, logic, and intellect. It's a very difficult concept to understand and to be comfortable with. Logic, reason, intelligence, that's the very underpinnings of society, of creation. That's the highest faculty in man. That's our inner compass. That's our navigation system. And we navigate through life and we do what's right and we make the good choices to do what's good and not what's bad. How do we know what's good or bad? We use, it's our mind that tells us. We can't always rely on our mind. Hashem gave us the Torah. But what's the Torah? The Torah is the divine wisdom, Hashem's reasoning. But it's still the intelligence. And here we say that Hashem transcends the intelligence. He is beyond intelligence. He's beyond all logic and he's beyond all reason. What's so hard to relate to that is because if logic is the basis of the differentiation between good and bad, then, and we know that we need to be good. So Hashem should also be good, and we expect of him that he is the ultimate good being. But if he's not bound by reason, so what's to determine what's good or what's bad? But the truth is that Hashem transcends the very concept of good and bad. But that's difficult. So we can really get into this and get all caught up in a very long time, since it's not the discussion for tonight. But just one thought. If we can imagine a type of good that's better than good, it has all the qualities of good, but not the limitations of what the word good means. Just, again, it's hard to imagine that. It doesn't have any bad to it. It's a supreme good that's beyond any definition of good. So it's beyond the limitations of a good that comes from reason and understanding. So Hashem's very self transcends all description. He's beyond intellect and beyond reason. He did create or bring about the realm of reason as part of the preparatory state to create the creation. So he created the world based on reason. Kulam b'chachma asisa. He made the world with wisdom. But he himself is beyond. And the truth is, logic itself tells us that reason and intelligence is not absolute. That there is a dimension that's beyond reason. Because if logic and if reason would be absolute, then there would be two things that are absolute. Hashem is absolute. And reason is absolute. That can be, because then there would be two gods. So there has to be, there's only one absolute being, and that's Hashem. And then there is reason. The only way we can reconcile the two, we say, well, if reason is an absolute thing and logic, and how can it fit with Hashem being the exclusive one and the only one who is absolute? We can say that Hashem is logic. He is the highest reason, he is the highest intelligence. And then intelligence is absolute because that's who Hashem is. Well, the Rambam, I mean that he says that. The Rambam says that Hashem is who Yedeya who Amad, that Hashem is the supreme intelligence. However, the Kabbalists take issue with the Rambam very strongly. Great philosophers, the Maharal particularly, is very, very strong against the Rambam in that. What do you mean? Hashem is reason, Hashem is seichel. It says two things. First of all, that you're giving him a description. And you're limiting him by the very fact that you're giving him a certain character, a certain description. That's a limitation. Hashem is limitless. But more than that, he says, if Hashem would be reason, then why do the sages refer to Hashem as HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Which means the transcendental one, the holy one, blessed is he. They should call Hashem HaSeichel Baruch Hu. The seichel, blessed is he. The intelligence, blessed is he. They precisely use the word HaKadosh to say that Hashem Kadosh means separated, beyond. They're saying that the name that we can give Hashem, the name, his name is that he is nameless. His personality is that he's personalityless. His character is that he's characterless. He's beyond all definition and beyond all description. Now, doesn't mean that the Rambam is wrong, chas v'shalom. When Hashem chose to create the world, he contracted himself, limited himself, projected of himself attributes of the attribute of reason, chachma being the first of the attributes. Meaning, he constricted, limited, and confined himself to become an intelligent being. Not just that he created intelligence, a system of intelligence. That's how he runs the world, through intelligence. No, rather, he himself identifies with the intelligence. He becomes, so to speak, an intelligent being. When at the same time, he infinitely transcends intelligence. So there's sort of two dimensions. There is a dimension of Hashem where Hashem is constricted, limited, and defined by various different descriptions of emotional descriptions and intellectual description. And then there is Hashem's very self, who as they refer to him as the Ein Sof, the boundless one, the one without an end. However, he doesn't relate to the world from that infinite, transcendental, indescriptive place. He interacts with the world through the spheres, through the attributes. Creation begins after the contraction into the attributes, where he assumes a personality. He relates to the world through his personality, not in that infinite dimension of where beyond all personality. And therefore, the creations only have a relationship with Hashem as Hashem is already conditioned himself to be the creator, not beyond that. There's, however, one exception. There's one being, there's one element that is connected and reaches and touches Hashem's very self, and that is the Jewish people. The Jewish people are connected to the Ein Sof himself, beyond all these spheres, beyond all the attributes, to Hashem's very self. Why? Because we are his children. As the pasuk says, "Bonem atam Hashem Elokeichem," you're my child. A child is connected to the very essence of the father, not to the attributes, not to the character traits, not to the intelligence. The relationship of father and child or mother and child is not based on reason, on rationale. It's much deeper than that. It's from their very self, from the very core of their being, of who they are. You don't love your children because they're cute, because they're smart, because they're nice, because they're good, because they're intelligent. You love your children because this is my child. That's where the love comes from. It's an ahava atzmis. It's an essential love. And therefore you can have a serial killer that is being put to death, being executed, and the mother is standing there and she's crying, and you try to talk reason to her, tell her this is a mass murderer, he has committed the most heinous, despicable crimes, he's a rotten to the core. What do you care? He should die. You can have all the therapists in the world speaking to this woman, it means nothing. She's crying. She wants her child to live. Why? You're speaking logic. You're speaking to her mind. She might be a smart woman, a brilliant lady, but her mind is irrelevant now. Her connection to her child comes from a much deeper place than her mind. It comes from her essence. She's connected in her essence. And over there is no reason. My child should live. Why? Because he's my child. Shem says about the Yidden, Banim Atim, you're my children. Bein kachu, bein kach atim, kruyim boyim, as the sages say. Whether you deserve it, whether you don't deserve it, whether you're good or you're bad, you are my children. I love you because you're my children. Not because of your virtues, not because of you deserve. La'achlifam bi'uma acheres i'efshar, to switch them, to exchange them for a different nation. Hashem says, I can't. If God forbid, chas v'shalom, the Jewish people would diminish in their observance and so forth, and they would lose their virtue and favor in Hashem's eyes, and another nation would excel in deserving of Hashem's love. Hashem says, I can't exchange you. Why? Because you are mine, because I love you, because I, with an absolute love. It's as absolute as Hashem is his love to the Jewish people. Therefore, it's an unbreakable bond. Usually, this dimension, this deeper element, the inner aspect of Hashem's self, is not visible and not active. As I mentioned earlier, it's not interacting with the creation. This dimension of Hashem remains remote, removed, and Hashem relates to the world from the vantage of reason, deserving and non-deserving. You deserve, you get rewarded, you deserve to be rewarded, you get rewarded, you deserve to be punished, you get punished. However, there are certain times in history when there's a glimmer, when it opens up and Hashem reveals and He connects to the world from the place beyond all the attributes. The very Ein Sof Himself makes Himself visible, and that is when it's connected to the very existence of the Jewish people. Because this is that touches them in that place. And that's where Makas Bechoris came from. And that is why, true, the Makkah was about punishment, and they deserve punishment. But here Hashem was revealing His love. Hashem, I love you, Hashem said. Hashem says, doesn't make a difference. They deserve, don't deserve. You're my children. I love them and I hate their tormentors. Everything else is irrelevant. And that is why the Makkah had to take place b'chatzos, at midnight. Dafka midnight. That was the moment when this could be revealed. The world operates in a system of time. The system of time is a rotation, and there are various different time zones. There is the time, there's day, and there is night. And then there is the week, and there is the month, and so forth. This rotation, and the movement of time, there is an underlying cause. What's beneath it that's moving time along? The underlying cause of time is the various different emotional attributes of Hashem that are projecting at that particular time. So, if Hashem is projecting chesed, kindness, He's feeling kind, He's feeling loving to the world, it's daytime, light. Light is revelation. Chesed keil kol hayoyim, chesed of Hashem all day, it's light, it's revelation. If there is Hashem's might, severance, gvura, that translates into darkness, it translates into evening, concealment. These two forces of kindness and severity, these are the primary emotions. Chesed and Gevura. And they really don't begin just in the emotion, they begin in the intelligence. We said before the process, the core, the platform of creation is Hashem's intelligence. But in the intelligence, in the mind and reasoning, there is the reason to be kind, the reason for find favor or innocence, and the reason, and the reasoning for guilt. So it's to give or not to give. So the intellect already over there is a two sides, a chesed element and a gevura element. But then it translates into the emotions, and through the emotions, it manifests itself in the world in the time of night and day. Now the way it really works is like this, that you have daytime, but at midday is when, from midday until midnight, is when the power of Gevura is triggered and begins to affect. So even though at midday it's the brightest moment, it's so powerful, the sun in mid-sky, but it's at that time that darkness is beginning. The sun is beginning to set. So we're moving into a process of less light, diminishment of light, less revelation. That's Gevura. And that's why we know that the afternoon is a time of Gevura. Mincha time is a time of Gevura. It's a time of Dinim. Mincha is connected to Yitzchak. Yitzchak is Midas Adin. And as the night progresses, it gets darker and darker. All highlighting, expanding the attribute of Gevura, of strength, of severity, of strictness, of discipline. Until it reaches its very, very, in the darkest moment, that's right, the moment before midnight. But then the pendulum swings and kindness kicks in. And it's so dark at midnight, but it's already moving towards day. We don't see light. We won't see light until the crack of dawn. But that's only down here below in our realm is when the light finally reaches here. But within Hashem, so to speak, it's kind of cool, kaviyachal all this, so to speak within Hashem, the mood is changing. It's a mood of generosity, of kindness, of openness. That's why we know that Chatzos midnight is a very auspicious time. People, tzaddikim, or just many yidden would wake up in the middle of the night to daven, to get close to Hashem. The early hours of the morning is very, very, very great time for a person to evoke divine mercy, to daven, to say tehillim if you need something. You want to come close to Hashem, it's the morning hours. Vayashkem Avraham baboiker. Avraham is chesed. Chesed rises in the morning. The morning is the time of kindness. And it gets stronger and stronger and stronger until midday. And then again it switches into Midas HaGevurah. However, the question is, what causes the switch? What causes the switch? How does it change? How does it change suddenly, especially at the strongest moment of Gevurah, how does it become chesed? At the strongest moment of kindness, when the light is at its brightest, how does it suddenly swing over, make a 180-degree turnaround, and become Gevurah? And the answer is, it's not from within the system. That's from outside. If you take, let's say, for instance, a human being. A person is, let's say, in a very condescending mood, a very pessimistic mood, in a very accusing mood. And you're just upset at someone or something. And it's festering in you. It's growing. And it turns into anger, then into rage. So you can't just by a drop of the hat or at that moment say, oh, you know what, I'm changing. And now I'm just feel so loving and generous and kind and affectionate towards that person. You can't do that. The only way you can change is you need an outside help. You need something from the outside to introduce something new to cause that change. So you need someone else to come and give you a new idea, throw in the benefit of the doubt, or tell you that, you know, what you thought about the other person isn't true, or look at it in perhaps in a different way and shift and change your attitude at that moment. An outsider doesn't mean an outside person. It can be yourself. It can be you read something, you saw something. Could just be that you went out of that place that you were in, you went to sleep, you wake up in the morning. So when you were asleep, you left that path that you were in, went outside of it, and you were able to go on to another path. That is the path of kindness. But while you're in it, you can't change it. So when Gevurah, the same as above, when the attribute of Chesed, the attribute of Gevurah, in order for it to switch, there needs to be a power of beyond. What's the power of beyond? That's the power of midnight. It's the moment of midnight, or it's perhaps a momentless moment. It's at midnight when these two meet at a point where there is no time. It's at that, because over there at that point, that's where the infinite, the inattributic aspect of Hashem, His very self that's beyond all attributes, gets involved. And that causes the switch between Chesed and Gevurah. That's the power of that moment of midnight. Because, again, you can't really call it a moment because it's higher than time. Because, again, time is based on the attributes. And this is an introduction where time touches beyond time. And that's the only intervention of the Ein Sof into the creation is at the Chatzais moment, at the midnight moment. And it is precisely for that reason that Makas Bechoris had to take place at midnight. Because we said earlier, Makas Bechoris is an expression of the Ein Sof, because the Makas coming from an unreasonable, irrational love and bond that Hashem has with the Yidden, that generally remains hidden and beyond and removed and remains within Hashem's, within Himself, and not projected into the creation. In order for that to make its way into the creation, the window, the crack, through where that energy can flow, is midnight moment. Because in the midnight, over there is the space between the attributes. What is higher than the attributes can be. And that is why it was so important, Chatzos. And Moshe Rabbeinu had to say this to Paroi. When he spoke to Pari and he described to him what kind of plague was going to come, he told him that the plague is going to take place at Chatzos. Why? because Pharaoh wouldn't believe it otherwise. Pharaoh was a smart man. They were very cunning, the Egyptians. He'd come to them and tell them a plague is coming, and the purpose of the plague was to destroy, to punish, to break. Pharaoh would say, how can that be? Punish us? You ain't no saint either. You're not tzaddikim any also. You're sinners like us. It would be impossible. There cannot be such a plague. So Moshe Rabbeinu says to Pharaoh, no, this is chatzos. This is coming from beyond the system. This is coming from a place that you have no connection to, you know nothing about. This is a place where there are different rules. Hashem isn't playing by the rules of logic. This is what he wants from his very self. And over the year, he loves the Jewish people. The emphasis that it was going to take place at Chatzos. But now the question is, if that's the case, so why did the Jews need a sign? Why do they have to put up the Dam Pesach? Why do they have to put up the Dam Mila, the blood of the circumcision? You don't need a sign. The plague itself cannot harm them. Because of it's a revelation of the irrational love that Hashem has to B'nai Yisrael, to Yidden. So they cannot be harmed. So why do they need to put the Pesach and the Dam Pesach and the Dam Mila, the blood, as a sign? Everything that comes to the world, every influence, every flow of energy into the world must be stimulated and drawn down through the Avodah, through the service of the Jewish people. Yidden are the conduit of godliness to the world. And that is true about everything. Even the forces, what makes nature tick, are Yidden. And they, in the manner that they serve Hashem, this is the way, like it says, Hashem Tzilcha, Hashem is your shadow. So for instance, if we want to emphasize and cause a flow of kindness, so by us doing charity and giving tzedakah and so forth, we're exercising kindness that's causing Hashem to exercise His kindness, to increase His kindness. When we're being disciplined where we're supposed to, discipline and projecting our own severity, our own gevura. So that causes Hashem's gevura also. And we need gevura sometimes to punish the wicked. Melech b'mishpat yamed aretz. But it's through our gevura, in our own lives, in a good way, in a positive way, that brings positive gevura into the world. Through our Torah study, when Yidden learn Torah, that highlights, pronounces Hashem's intelligence. That you can see that the intelligence that of Hashem should be pronounced in the way He runs the world. The world should look like a jungle, like madness. No, there is a cheshbin, there is reason, there is justice. That's through Torah study, we're increasing the flow of chachma, the revelation of chachma in the world. And that is also true when Hashem wants to introduce something that is beyond even the attributes from His very self, which really, He's coming, He's something that He initiates. Nevertheless, even that, He wants us to be part of it. And He wants us to be the ones that will evoke it, stimulate it. And more than that, in order for the world to be a keli, the world to be a vessel for that energy, for that light, we need to create the vessel, we need to make something that is going to serve as a container, as a holder for that intense revelation. So it was necessary that Yidden should do something in their service of Hashem, something that expresses an irrational commitment to Hashem, something that's coming from their core, transcending logic. And that is why it was the Dam Pesach and the Dam Mila, the blood of the Korban Pesach and the blood of the circumcision. Both these mitzvahs express the irrational commitment and connection and devotion that Yidden have to Hashem. In the Bris Mila, we know a Mila is a covenant. Covenant. What's a covenant? A covenant is a commitment, a deep, powerful commitment of loyalty, of devotion, that you're committed to the relationship, that you need to care about each other. The question is, why are you doing it with a baby? 8-day-old baby doesn't know what's flying with himself. Wait. You'll make a bris. Who can make a bris? An older person. Person child will be born, as parents, we'll educate our children. We'll give them the information, the knowledge. They'll understand. They'll appreciate Hashem. They'll appreciate what it means to be an Eved Hashem, a servant of Hashem, how great it is. And then they'll finally reach the point that they're ready to make a commitment. At an older, with an older, mature age, now they can go ahead and make a commitment to Hashem. Go into a bris with Him. We don't do that. We make the bris dafka when the baby's 8 days old. Why? And the answer is because this bris, this covenant, this is not a connection. This is not a relationship based on rationale and reason. It's because we understand or appreciate Hashem through our minds. If we would make a bris when we would be at an older age, that would be indicative that our relationship with God is a rational one. True, there is the reason and the rationalization, and we have to use our minds to increase and to develop in our relationship with Hashem and to grow in our relationship. But the core of our connection to Hashem is the pintel yid, is an attachment to Hashem that is beyond all explanation and all reason. Over here, we're willing to give everything. We're willing to give our lives, everything we own, our very existence up for Hashem. Why? Because we're bonded with Him. With an absolute bond. That's what the bris conveys, a bris of an eight-day-old baby. Same is also from Hashem's perspective. He's bonding with an eight-day-old child. When you're bonding with a child of 8 days, you're saying, this is my man, this is my person. This is who I'm going to be committed to. How do you know what the child is going to turn out to? How do you know that once the baby grew older and he's lived a virtuous life and made good choices, and so then you say, well, this person deserves my protection. This person deserves my love. This person deserves to be in a covenant with me. The answer is, this is Hashem's children. All your children deserve to be in a covenant with you. Because it's not about deserving in terms of virtue. It's because these are your children. You love your children because they're your children. And that's what the bris says. So when the Yidden made the bris, this was an indication of the beyond reason of their commitment, of their connection to Hashem. The Korban Pesach, same thing. Korban Pesach, the Yidden were asked to do a ridiculous thing. Let's just imagine the Jewish people in Egypt. The Yidden have been in Mitzrayim for a bitter exile of 210 years. During this time, they were beaten, they were crushed, they were murdered, they were abused, manipulated, stripped from all their dignity, from all their sense of pride, definitely of independence. They lived in constant fear, dread, and terror of the Egyptian tormentors. We can imagine that when they just heard that one of the Egyptian gods was anywhere in the neighborhood, they shivered and trembled in fear. And here they were told to take the very god of Mitzrayim, the very idol, the Mitzri, which the Mitzrim bowed down to or believed in, and slaughter it in front of the Egyptians' eyes. Because they didn't do it privately in their basements. They had to tie it to their beds. And from the Medrash, it's clear that this was something that became very known for 4 days. Incredible brazen chutzpah. How do you do that? It's equivalent, if you can imagine, Jews in the concentration camps. After they've been there for a while, would one day take the picture of Hitler, Yamach Shemoy, and trample on it in front of the Nazis' eyes. I mean, it'd be unheard of. How can people do that? They wouldn't have the courage. Can't have the courage to do something like this. And here, thousands and thousands of Yidden all rose to the occasion and did what they needed to do. Why? This is suicidal. This makes no sense. The answer is, Hashem asked us to do so. Doesn't make a difference. Here is where they reveal their supernatural. They show that they are insanely Jewish. And their connection to Hashem is beyond all reason, beyond all calculations of their own well-being. They're doing because Hashem said so. And it was precisely because of that that the Pesach and the blood of the Milah was their protection. Because when they put this blood on the door, and the mashkes came down, and Hashem, and there was a destruction, and there was an accusation against them. So as they revealed their ahava atzmis, their absolute love to Hashem, this evoked from Hashem also His love to the earth. They're mine, and I love them forever. Sages also tell us that the schus, the merit that the Yidden went out of Mitzrayim, was in the schus of Amunah. B'schus of the Amunah, the Yidden went out of Egypt. Now, the other Medrash says that the schus that the Yidden had, that the Yidden went out of Mitzrayim, was the schus of their the Mila and the schus of the Karban Pesach. So which one is it? In the Mechilta it says it was schus Amunah, and in the other Medrash it says it's the schus of. So we can say it's an argument amongst the Midrash. But we know that whenever we can reconcile, whenever we can bring together two things, and so that it's not an argument, we try to do so. Amunah is the same thing. The Amunah that we're talking about was when Moshe Rabbeinu came to them, and Moshe Rabbeinu told them that they're going out of Mitzrayim. They believed in Moshe. They didn't believe. They believed that they were going to be redeemed. They believed that Mashiach was coming for them. Now, if we just think about the condition, the mental and emotional condition of the Jewish people during that time. Just imagine this, okay? They're living in a land that the sages tell us, we hear about this as children, but we don't realize it sometimes, we don't visualize it. We're talking about a place where it says that during its entire history, not one slave was able to escape. They had the most incredible border control in Mitzrayim. No one ever left Egypt. And here, they were told that a few million people were going to leave. Just like, this is before the plague, so they haven't seen any plagues yet. Moshe comes one day and tells them that they were all going out of Egypt. Hashem remembered them, and He's going to take them out. Insane, it's absurd, how is that possible? The entire infrastructure of the Egyptian slavery was going to come toppling down. How is it possible to believe that? And especially if you take their emotional condition of how crushed and beaten and broken they were after a century was mainly the main hard work was for over 100, a century of brutality, of servitude. And worse than all of this, we know that this destruction came to the Jewish people. This destruction came to the Jewish people after. This Besura, this was at the end of the Golus. This came to the Yidden after the Gezerah of their children. We know the softest spot by a person is their child. If you harm their child, that can break the child person more than anything else. And from your children itself, it's your babies, little children. And here they had gone through the decree of thousands of their babies were cast into the Nile. What this did to them, how this broke them and destroyed them. And here, in this condition, Moshe Rabbeinu comes to them and tells them that Hashem, they're going to go out. And they believed him. Why did they believe him? Because Amunah comes from your inner neshama. It's higher than your human faculties. Amunah is not coming from your seichel. Amunah is not you believe because it makes sense. Because this is what your mind tells you. That's not Amunah. That's Seichel. Amunah is a firm recognition in something because of your... Or a recognition in Hashem and belief and faith in what Hashem tells you because you're connected with Him. With an absolute neshama bond. Higher than understanding and higher than reason. We say that Amunascha Baleilois. Amunah I have at night. Balela, when I don't understand, when it's dark, when it makes no sense, that's Amunah. And that Amunah was expressed. And that's why the Amunah is the same expression of the super rational connection Yidden have with Hashem. And when Yidden revealed their Amunah, this in turn exposed Hashem's super rational love to the Yidden. However, if that's the case, why they also need the Dam Pesach? And why they also need the Dam Mila, the blood of the Mila? They had their Amunah and the Amunah. And the answer is Emunah takes place deep inside your heart. Emunah is an inner feeling at the core of your heart, at the core of your being. You believe. True, when they had Emunah, it evoked Emunah. It evoked the love of Hashem. Where? Kiviyachol, so to speak, in Hashem's heart. High, deep, 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 within Hashem's inner heart. Just like the Emunah is inside our inner recesses, in our inner crevice, inside our embedded in our, in the deepest, in the core of our soul, we have our Emunah. So in the core of Hashem, there is that love to the Yidden. But it's not enough if the love is evoked there. The love needs to be expressed. It needs to come out. Hashem's love has to make a change in the demographics of this world. Egypt has to be broken. The Yidden have to come out. There has to be a change in the outer elements of creation. That energy has to be drawn down from the innermost of Hashem and brought out into the outer crust of existence, into this physical world. In order for that to happen, Yidden also had to do that kind of an avodah. They had to take their emunah and express it into action, in expression into their external existence. That is why they made the Bris Milah. The Bris Milah expresses this inner connection to Hashem into their flesh. They made a sign in their flesh, in their body, not in their soul. And then when they made the Korban Pesach even more, they exposed it. They did it with something outside of them. A korban outside. The animal was shechti. Avodah Zarah Mitzrayim was destroyed. And it was done. This was exposed to the media of Mitzrayim. This was brought out in the most external, public way. So what was hidden deep, deep inside was completely open and revealed, and conspicuous for everyone to see. So this would reveal from Hashem too, his love for the Jewish people, and it should be revealed in the outside of the world, and to activate and to bring about the redemption. All this is extremely applicable, very applicable to our days. We're living today in a time very similar to the Yidden in Egypt. We're also living at the end of an exile, the conclusion. A long and bitter exile, some ways even much harder than the Egyptian exile. And we are told that the redemption is close, we're there. We believe, achakaloi, we wait for Mashiach to come. When we look around the world today, and it's frightening. It doesn't seem like there's any reason, there's any way, conceivable way for a redemption. We look and we see, first of all, the spreading of terror in the world. Antisemitism is festering all over the world. The politics, the politicians have shifted and changed. And we don't know, but at least it is very suspicious. And even when we do have moments when things look good, afterwards there's a setback. And I'm wondering, a redemption? And when we're looking at the spiritual condition of the Jewish people, it doesn't make things look too good, too hopeful. So many of our brothers and sisters, so many, are oblivious to their Judaism and to what it means to be a Yid. But then even in our own communities, we look at our own communities. Chas v'shalom, don't want to look bad. We all know certain things that are just not good. And we see this and we see that, and we look at ourselves, of course, and we wonder how we're going to be worthy for redemption. How are we going to have the schus that Hashem should redeem us? It becomes very difficult. So similar to the Yidden when Moshe Rabbeinu came to them and there was nothing to hold on to, nothing to that they can see and make sense of. That's on the broader scale. But then we look at individual lives. Each and every one of us is an individual in Mitzrayim. We have our own Egyptian, we have our own constrictions and limitations and boundaries that we're bounded, both in the physical and in the spiritual. In the physical world, the financial stress that we're all in, the difficulties, and the terrible financial situation that just seems to get worse and worse every day. And what we believed in perhaps yesterday, this might help or that might help. A day later, that comes crashing down. And it gets worse and worse, and it seems like there's no end to the tunnel, and Yidden are petrified. So many have lost their jobs. So many have no idea how they're going to support their families, how they're going to pay the mortgage, how they're going to pay the rent. It's frightening. And there's no logic, no rational, there's nothing to explain. It's very dark and scary. And then, of course, when we look at our emotional, our spiritual condition, we find ourselves in Egypt. All of us have our own Egypts. We have these various different things that we're trapped in. We're trapped, imprisoned in our own, by our own paro. Various different behavioral patterns, various emotions, lusts and cravings that we so badly want to overcome. Fears, insecurities that we struggle with, and we struggle, and we fight all our lives. So many of us who are fought again and again and again, we're trying to climb out, break out, as we're climbing the barbed wire, and our hands are tearing, our flesh is tearing, we've fallen down so many times, we're trying to climb, but it's a slippery slope, and we keep on falling down, and we fall into despair. And then we think that, who says, maybe Hashem is just upset at me, he doesn't like me anymore, and I'm just going to stay in this miserable state forever and ever. What we have to remember is, we need to keep that midnight window open. We need to keep the window of our faith, of our amunah, of the purity of our neshama, where our neshama is attached to Hashem, where we know that Hashem loves us no matter what. He promised that he's going to take the Jewish people out of exile, and he's going to do it whether we deserve it or whether we don't, whether it makes sense, whether we can see it or whether we can't see it. And we know that we are not slaves. Just like the Yidden and Mitzrayim, they're not slaves, they had a destiny. We are not slaves to our impulses, we're not slaves to our Yetzer Hara. We all have a destiny. Even if we can't see it, how, what? And the Yetzer Hara is so smart, and he says to us, well, you know, you tried so many times, and you see it didn't work for this one, it didn't work for that. Doesn't make a difference. As long as our emunah is strong, and we don't fall into despair, the window of redemption is open. The transcendental, infinite light of that will bring the Geula has a way to get to us. There is a pathway, a passageway for that light, for that energy. Through that window, the window of Emunah, we have to keep the Emunah open. Chas v'shalom, never fall into despair. We believe Emunah Shalema, with absolute faith that Mashiach is coming, and we're going out of this goddess, both as a whole and as an individual. But it's not just enough to believe, as we said earlier. The Emunah would stir that great energy, that great light. But in order for it to manifest itself, to enclose itself within the world, it needed to find practical, concrete application. So we need to take that amunah too and reveal it in concrete, in something concrete. And that means that we have to shecht our korban Pesach, shecht the avodah zarah of Mitzrayim. We shouldn't be afraid of that Egyptian tormentor that we're so terrified of. We shouldn't scare. We should laugh. We should go in his face and slaughter the lamb of Mitzrayim, the god of Mitzrayim. Which means we should do something that is so chutzpah to that Yetzer Hara, so antithetical, just to show him that he's not the boss. And we believe in Hashem, and we believe in the power of redemption. So, for example, those who are, so many are scared to give tzedakah, because we don't know, we don't have the extra money. We maybe once gave. Maybe we have the money to give right now, but we don't know. We're so terrified of what we're going to have, what's going to be tomorrow. Offering your Korban Pesach means giving the tzedakah, giving even more than you used to give. Doing an act of total faith, contrary, a revelation, a redemption act, a Mashiach act, with absolute trust and bitachon. Namun and Hashem, that the Abishter is going to support us. He's going to protect our livelihood. He's going to protect our panas. and he's going to bring Mashiach, and he's going to take us out. Bekarev, Bekarev. Literally Bekarev, all of us. And we're going to march to Yerushalayim, Yer HaKodesh, Mashiach Tzidkenu.
תחזיק חזק, הלב חזק שלי, כי לא תמיד הכל בחוץ בהיר, ברוח שר וסופה קרה.
תזכור, תתחזק, אני איתך.
אני איתך.
תחזיק חזק, עלה קטן שלי.